Coming up next on Tech News Weekly, we'll be wrapping up Mobile World Congress and talking a little bit about Samsung, what they brought to Mobile World Congress. Also, Microsoft goes to the Supreme Court for data privacy, an AI-fueled, if not just a little bit expensive, camera from Google, and what Amazon might do with its latest acquisition of Ring. All that and more coming up next on Tech News Weekly.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Weekly is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Tech News Weekly, episode 21, recorded Thursday, March 1st, 2018.
This episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by Kubernetes Engine on Google Cloud Platform. Learn more at g.co/getgke today. Welcome to Tech News Weekly. This is the show where we get to talk to the people making and breaking the tech news. I am Megan Maroney.
And I'm Jason Howell. Mobile World Congress is totally wrapped up now, right?
It's wrapped up. Barcelona was beautiful this year, wasn't it?
Wasn't it? Yeah, the jamón that I've experienced in the past 5 days, breathtaking.
Yes, we weren't there.
No.
Mobile World Congress, as we said, is wrapping up in Barcelona, with or without us, and joining us to talk about everything that's new in rectangular communication devices is Shara Tibkin from CNET. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start with the Samsung Galaxy S9. A lot of the headlines I read complained that there's just nothing new in this phone, but you write that it's all about the refinements. Tell us what you mean by that.
Yeah, I think for any handset maker, it's getting really hard to come out with something that's dramatically different every single generation. We've even seen that with Apple. They basically had the same phone design for 3 years before they came out with the 10. Samsung had really big changes last year with the Galaxy S8. It ditched the home button before Apple did. It had a lot of other new things in that device. So for them to make huge dramatic changes with the S9 was kind of expecting too much, I think. For them, it was really about making changes and doing things that we actually need from our devices. I don't know if you guys have used Samsung devices before, but in the past, they used to just have so much kind of crap on it that you didn't even know existed. Like all of these features that you're like, oh, wow, that sounds cool, but you have absolutely no idea how to actually access it. And this time, the things they're doing are things that are just like right there in front of your face, like the camera updates, a new way to unlock the phone, these animated emojis. They're all things that you know, you're going to run into.
Yeah, I'd always give, especially in the last few years, Samsung credit for realizing kind of what some of the criticism had been for years in their design and what they were offering, and really doing an about face. Their devices are top notch from a design perspective, almost to the point to where, like what you're talking about, maybe a big kind of visual refresh is completely unnecessary. If it works, it works. Then, you know, kind of go internal inside and work on those things too, which seems like that's what they're doing.
Yeah, I mean, like, if you look at what they've done with the camera, they've really focused on low light, which is a big issue for phones. Like, if you try to take any pictures when it's dark, it's going to be grainy. They're not going to look good. But when you, with the new Samsung phone, it's supposed to make it much sharper. I saw a demo where they had this sort of canister, and you could look in it with your eye and kind of make out that there was a house and little cars, but I couldn't really see the colors. And then when you take a picture with the S9, you could see like, oh, the house has a red roof. These cars are driving around and they're colorful. So I was impressed by that. We'll have to see what reviewers actually say when they get more time on this, actually using it in real life as opposed to this kind of controlled environment. Mm-hmm. But Samsung really tried to do things that it's going to just make your whole experience better.
It almost feels like we're getting so desperate for something new that we start to like really put a lot of stock in things that are just sort of bizarre. I mean, like the fingerprint reader under the glass. Like everyone's like, oh, when is Samsung going to do that? When is Apple going to put the fingerprint under the glass? Like that's some sort of amazing thing. Like, did you hear anything, anybody talking about that?
Yeah, I mean, that was one thing people, I think, were hoping from with the Galaxy S9. So Apple's gone to Face ID with the iPhone X, which is unlocks when it looks at your face. I personally have a lot of problems with it. It doesn't unlock reliably for me. So I end up typing in my password, I don't know, a million times a day. With Samsung, they had previously offered face unlocking technology, but it isn't actually secure. I mean, it's kind of secure, but not secure enough for anything like mobile payments or any serious things you want to do on your phone. They also had Iris, which would unlock when your eyes were at the perfect height, aligned, perfect distance. It was really kind of finicky. You had to kind of have everything perfect. And for most people, the fingerprint has just been so easy. You just touch it and it opens. And, you know, it was kind of this like great promise of being able to touch the front of your device again. So you don't have to deal with kind of having a fingerprint sensor in a weird position on the back of the phone, like we saw with the Galaxy S8, or just not having one at all, like with the iPhone X. Samsung actually came out with a new sort of way to unlock your phone that they call intelligent scan. It combines face unlock and the iris to let you into the phone really quickly. But the way it kind of works is first, if it tries to authenticate with your face first, and then if that doesn't work, it'll, you know, instantaneously try with your irises, then it'll try a combination of the both. But basically, it's not very secure. The Galaxy S8, you could fool it with a picture. It's not like the iPhone where you have to have kind of this moving image. So, you know, everybody's just trying to find ways to help you get into these devices really quickly, but also keep it secure. And it seems like, you know, in the case of Samsung, what they just came out with, it's kind of opting for the convenience over the ultra strong security.
Which is a real bummer, because when I first heard, I think we heard about that a little bit in the rumor mill prior to it being announced, my initial thought was, great, this is what I've been hoping for the last couple of years, combined metrics. If you've got a fingerprint sensor and you've got my eyes and everything, like, allow me to put all of that together at one time, and then you take something that was maybe less secure on its own, and it becomes even more secure when it's combined with all this other stuff. But that's not the direction that they went. It's kind of doing this, try this first, and if that doesn't work, then try that, which really keeps it at the same security standpoint when you compare it to something like Face Unlock or Face
ID. Yeah, totally. You know, it's not anywhere near their Face Unlock technology isn't close to as secure as what we have on the iPhone, or at least that's what security researchers say. Right. And we'll have to see what actually, after people get this in their hands and researchers try to crack it, we'll have to see how easy or difficult it is. But, you know, it isn't really like a huge dramatic change. It's kind of just combining what they had before. You know, they've improved the iris, they've improved the face unlocking on the S9, but it still isn't like ultra secure grade. That you're going to be able to just use your face for Samsung Pay or any of these other high security applications.
Sure. And then when we were talking about the fingerprint sensor under the display, of course, we saw something at Mobile World Congress that does this. It was a concept. But what can you tell us about Vivo's Apex concept?
You know, I don't actually know a lot about that, but there's been a chip maker who works on screen sensor technology who'd worked on something like this. That's kind of why we all thought that we were going to see something from Samsung sooner rather than later. Samsung tends to really kind of be at the front when it comes to hardware changes in phones. Like, they come out with a lot of technology pretty early, because they develop everything themselves. They have a big components business. They make displays. They manufacture their own phones. They put their own phones together. I think it's only a matter of time before we see something from them.
Mm-hmm. What about the foldable phone, the elusive foldable phone? Is that coming?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, they're still talking about this. One of my colleagues managed to get a little time with Samsung's CEO at the Unpacked event in Barcelona. And what he said was that they're still working on it. They want to make sure it's not just gimmicky, which I think is really good, because it would be easy for Samsung to show some sort of concept device and be like, oh, wow, look, your phone can fold in half, and there's no actual practical reason that you need this. So I think it's promising that they're trying to figure out reasons why you would want a foldable phone. And, you know, it's kind of funny, like we saw in the fourth quarter, smartphone sales fell for the first time ever, basically since all of these firms started tracking smartphones, since smartphones really came out. And one of the reasons was people who have flip phones have kind of decided that they want to stick with their flip phones. They're not suddenly needing to go to smartphones, which is which I think is really interesting. So if there's some sort of foldable device that can kind of bridge between a smartphone and a flip phone, that could be interesting. You know, Nokia came out with a banana phone, like a feature phone at Mobile World Congress. You know, that was something that everybody was kind of talking about. And, you know, I think that there's people out there, I think there's some value in having different devices where we don't always just need this rectangular touch screen, I guess.
And some value in devices that are including the notch, because we saw a little bit. Samsung didn't go in that direction.
No, but, they made a dig. Yeah. During their press conference, they made a little comment that, oh, there's no notch on this, as you'll see. I don't understand this trend by other companies to copy Apple so closely that they literally will include the notch. Like when the iPhone 10 came out, it seemed like the notch was something that you kind of had to excuse, like, right. Oh, you know, this phone's perfect, but it has this notch, but you know, here's why you have this notch and like, it's okay. And now it's a feature that people are actually releasing.
That's what I'm trying to figure out too. That's totally where I'm at right now. Because obviously now it's become a trend. It was at first, it was this thing, like you say, that seemed to be like, well, we had to do this in order to make it work. And now it's becoming a trend. And I'm trying to figure out, like, is it a trend because Apple did it? Or is it a trend because if what you're trying to do is maximize display on an entire front of the phone, like you have to do something around, because we expect for there to be things like front facing cameras and that sort of stuff. So you have to do something to it that adds a little bit more display, display, you know, area for the display. I guess it's a little bit of both though, because.
Yeah. But I mean, but like with that it's kind of wasted space because you can't really, like for an app, like you can't take advantage of kind of the notch area. It's kind of unusual. Like on Samsung's devices, because it has the same thing where it has the display is across the entire front of the phone, but they don't have a notch. They just have, you know, it's just kind of like flat, cut at the top. Like what if, you know, and like you don't even notice it. Like I personally don't even think like, oh, I wish the screen was like a little bit higher on the sides. Like you don't, I mean, at least that's not something I think of. Maybe other people are like, oh man, I wish, but I don't know. You know, it was a design decision by Apple to go with that. And, you know, I think them doing it made it acceptable. So then it's, you know, for other companies who are looking at making devices that have the display across the entire front, it's not as much of a taboo for them to do it too, I guess. And now it's a feature that people are touting.
Yep.
So you mentioned flip phones and the banana phone and feature phones. Was that an overall feeling at Mobile World Congress, since we are sort of in this moment where there's a lot of talk about tech addiction and how, you know, Apple needs to make the iPhone less interesting to people? Was that like, was, is it now seen as sort of taboo to make a phone really interesting lest we get addicted to it?
No, I mean, I think that that's a nice marketing thing when you know, it's hard to make devices dramatically different or really exciting. So it's like, oh, you know, we want to try to make it so you're not as addicted. Well, actually, like, handset makers would love for you to be more addicted to your devices. And so would app developers and everybody who's making this technology. You know, I think it's kind of a fact of just like where we are in the smartphone market. Like these devices, you know, the iPhone is over a decade old now, or a decade old at this point. There's, you know, they've all kind of like settled on this design for now, you know, until we see foldable phones or other things, other designs that, you know, still have to deal with kind of technological issues of being able to manufacture enough of them, you know, finding a practical purpose for them. So it's, you know, also pricing has changed. Like in the US, like these devices are getting more expensive. Like the new iPhones that are coming out are not getting cheaper. We're not seeing like a drop in price in them, we're seeing them, you know, the iPhone 10 starts at $1,000. You know, Samsung's phone is cheaper than that, but it's also, it's not a cheap device. So, you know, when you're not buying it on a 2-year contract for your carrier and only paying $200 to get it, you're paying $1,000 out of pocket. You're going to think about it a little longer before you're going to buy another one. You know, you're not going to buy another one in a year, probably. You know, some people will, but not most people are going to be holding on to these longer. And if you decide, hey, really all I want to do with my phone is actually text people and look at Google Maps, maybe there are some cheaper devices or even, you know, other sort of ways you can do that without having to spend $1,000.
So was there anything else at Mobile World Congress that caught your eye?
I actually wasn't there. I was here, but, you know, it was an interesting show this year because when Samsung tends to announce a phone at a trade show, it kind of dominates the news. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we saw quite a few handset makers who were going to talk about new phones there actually hold off on that. So, it kind of seemed Mobile World Congress this year was a big Samsung show and not that much else that was really, really exciting.
Well, Shara, thank you so much for joining us. Shara Timken is a senior reporter for CNET News, focused on Samsung and Apple. Her work can be found at CNET.com and Shara Timken on Twitter. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you, Shara.
Thanks so much.
We appreciate
Bye.
It. We'll talk to you soon. Feedback before we get into the next interview. Real quick here, Jacob writes, I just thought I'd correct your guest. I'm also a MoviePass goer, and you are about to you're about to use MoviePass with 3D or IMAX in most theaters. While it won't pay for the full cost, most of the time movie theater personnel will let you pay for the difference. I use this to see Thor in 3D. That's a good tip. I hadn't heard that you could actually apply it for partial. I wonder if that's like an official thing or movie theaters like, yeah, sure, why
I
not?
I think it probably depends on the movie theater.
Yeah.
I would guess. But yeah, that was our guest last week who talked about MoviePass, the $7.99 of all you can watch, except not all you can watch, all you can, one a day.
Right, one a day. That's all you really need, right? Right? I'm sure there are some people who would prove that wrong. Actually, I have a friend who would prove that wrong. But anyways, a case before the Supreme Court has the potential to change the protections that tech companies currently enjoy when storing its user data on servers outside of the U.S. Joining us to dive into the details of the United States versus Microsoft Corporation case is Selena Larson from CNN Tech. Welcome, Selena.
Hi, guys. How's it going?
It's going great. It's great to get you back. So let's go back to 2013 to kind of set the stage a little bit. Microsoft was issued a warrant that would involve giving up its data held in Ireland. Tell us a little bit about the kind of the germination of the case that we're seeing now.
Mm-hmm. So we don't know the specifics regarding the case, but they were served with a warrant back in 2013 for emails and information associated with an account related to a criminal drug trafficking investigation. Some of the information was stored locally in the U.S., and that information they would provide. But some of their information was stored in Ireland, and they're like, sorry, your warrant does not extend to data stored overseas. So they refused to release that information. It went up to the courts. A lower court judge approved the warrant, but they took it to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit, and they rejected the warrant in favor of Microsoft. So, you know, now it's up to the Supreme Court to decide this case and figure out whether that warrant applies to data stored overseas.
So what is Microsoft actually saying that the problem is with accessing these emails stored overseas?
So essentially they're arguing, well, first of all, that they're arguing that this isn't an issue for the courts to decide, but it should be Congress, because effectively the DOJ is arguing that the Stored Communications Act, which was written in 1986, which basically establishes the relationships between law enforcement and tech companies that deal with the data, that says that this is outdated. And so what they're calling on doesn't really cover cloud computing. And they say, you know, this is a case, the Stored Communications Act of 1986 doesn't apply to this particular case. It's, you know, something that needs to be updated and move forward. Essentially, they say, and privacy advocates say this too, that if, you know, we could just go and get data from overseas, then another country could say, oh, well, I can, you know, get data stored in the U.S. And so that's kind of the argument there.
Obviously, in 1986, the world is a lot different, you know, now versus 86. What exactly about the Stored Communications Act in 1986 differs? Like, what is the big reason that, it applied then, but it doesn't apply now?
So that law tried to establish a type of privacy that users can expect from their ISPs. And essentially it says, you know, tech companies, ISPs can't just turn over data to the law enforcement willy-nilly. It's essentially the Fourth Amendment protections that prohibit search and seizure, you know, to your house, your apartment or whatever, but applied to the internet. Mm-hmm. Currently we have fewer Fourth Amendment protections than your physical, you know, location, like your house. But back then when it was written, obviously, you know, data was stored in servers locally. It was stored on your computer. It wasn't, we didn't have these massive corporations storing vast amounts of data all over the world. Tech companies, Microsoft is arguing that this, this act should be, you know, updated, or the law should be updated to sort of figure out how laws apply when the information the U.S. wants is stored in foreign countries.
And Microsoft is also saying that this poses a risk to us in the United States. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So what's interesting actually is this argument was, they blogged about it a lot. And, a few amicus briefs were filed from foreign countries that were like, hey, this could, you know, impact a lot of different people's privacy. This could affect Europeans' privacy, Americans' privacy. Essentially, it would be sort of like a tit for tat potential, right? Where if they say that the U.S., oh, I can just go grab this data, then another country would say, well, we can grab your data too. Interestingly, though, that argument did not really come up all that much during arguments on Tuesday. It was more, you know, they were focusing less on the privacy issue or the potential for affecting Americans' privacy, and more on the fact that, you know, this is something that Congress should decide. This is up to the laws. This isn't, you know, it's outdated laws. If we do implement better protections and like write this out a little bit more, because if there were laws, like currently the Cloud Act has been proposed by some folks in Congress, that could effectively render this case totally moot by updating laws to sort of fit the current digital landscape.
And talking a little bit about the tit for tat potential that you're talking about there, I mean, talk a little bit about like what other governments could actually do in that regard. Like I've read a little bit about, you know, there are certain governments that you probably wouldn't want to have that ability, that access to, you know, or that, leverage, let's say, over, you know, in response to this. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. So what's kind of interesting is obviously, as you guys have probably talked about, a lot of the European privacy laws are a lot stricter than here in the U.S. and even more strict than a lot of places abroad. Right. So one of the things that was pretty interesting that I've been talking to a couple experts about is if this, you know, if they said unilaterally that the U.S. can just kind of go and take data from these companies or from, you know, data stored overseas or whatever, because it falls under U.S. regulations, it could potentially open up the possibility for foreign countries to say, oh, okay, well, you know, if these American companies are going to be able to say, oh, we're going to get this data in this foreign country because it, you know, it's U.S. law, we are going to require these foreign companies to have data stored on our property, like in our country. So then they have to comply to our laws. So it wouldn't be like, oh, US can just do whatever they want willy-nilly. It would be like, oh, well, you know, if you're not going to obey my country's laws, or if you're not going to, you know, take my citizens' privacy into consideration, then we're just going to force you to store data locally and abide by our rules. And so that's kind of interesting. It's a possibility that people have been talking about, that this might actually come up, and it could sort of create this similar to like what China is doing, right? So right. It's you know, the Great Firewall. It's like China has, you know, control over data stored in China. I mean, you just saw with Apple like storing iCloud information in China. So the concern is, if there's just this unilateral power for the U.S. to sort of go and do whatever they want, then, you know, these countries would be like, hold on, we have to sort of figure out how we can do this and protect, you know, people in our country. Hmm.
So privacy is one of those things that doesn't fall down party lines very often. In one of your pieces, you wrote that Rob Joyce, who's the cybersecurity coordinator for the NSC, the National Security Council, he says he agrees with Microsoft and looking to move on the Cloud Act, which you mentioned before. And you said that the Cloud Act would then, if that passed, it would make this whole thing moot. I mean, is the Cloud Act something that privacy advocates would look highly on, or is it something a little sketchy?
So it's actually pretty interesting. The act does have some bipartisan support. And again, it's just been introduced. I believe it was in early February. So it's still in the early stages. It hasn't even been marked up yet. But it is essentially a way for countries to enter these unilateral agreements to be like, oh, you know, if the U.S. has information that they want to get out of Ireland or the U.K. or elsewhere in Europe, then we sort of enter these agreements to say, OK, we can do that. But the agreement can only be struck if countries achieve certain human rights and privacy privacy boundaries, essentially, right? So it's essentially trying to protect the people in these countries and to protect the information. So, you know, if they enter this agreement, they only do so under those standards. However, some privacy activists say that these standards for privacy and human rights are not quite enough. They do... You know, it is an interesting step. Everyone pretty much acknowledges that it's a great step forward. It's a way to improve the law. It's a way to, you know, sort of establish this criteria for our world of the cloud, right? But you do have some concerns over, you know, these issues or these standards not being totally met. So essentially, you know, that does have bipartisan support. Microsoft, Facebook, Apple, Google, all the big companies support the Cloud Act. So it will be interesting to see moving forward. So for instance, in this case, right, it's Microsoft seeking data from Ireland. And theoretically, we would have had an agreement with the country and it would not have, we wouldn't have gone to court over this. So we would have been like, oh, we have this data agreement because you meet certain privacy and human rights guidelines. Let's exchange data.
Mm-hmm. And then if the Supreme Court ends up ruling in Microsoft's favor, are we to expect new laws around like data localization in response to that? Is that the type of stuff that we'd see in response?
So everybody basically says that no matter what the outcome of this case is, eventually Congress is going to have to act. Congress is going to have to enact new laws. We're going to have to update, you know, 1986, the laws written back then don't really apply anymore. It's really hard. You know, we have these like questions and, so if regardless of whoever wins in the case, Congress is ultimately going to have to legislate on this. And what's pretty interesting is Ruth Bader Ginsburg actually brought it up. Justice Ginsburg said, why are we doing this when, you know, Congress could potentially act on that? And it does seem like some of the justices were in favor of, you know, having legislation sort this out as opposed to, you know, the Supreme Court having to decide something. They're expected to rule on it by late June, and no matter the outcome, it's likely we'll get legislation. And the outcome will just affect this one case in particular because of the likely forthcoming legislation.
Interesting stuff. Selena Larson, really appreciate you taking the time to talk with us again. It's great to see you. Thank you.
Always a pleasure. Thanks, guys.
All right, CNN Tech. We'll talk to you soon, Selena.
Up next, how good is Google's new camera at taking videos of your cat? We'll answer that and other important tech questions with Jeffrey Fowler from The Washington Post. But first, this episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by Kubernetes Engine on Google Cloud Platform. When you're building an application, you need it to be fast, secure, and always evolving. With Kubernetes Engine, developers can easily deploy containerized apps on a fully managed service from Google Cloud Platform. Google has been running production workloads in containers for more than 10 years. And they built the best of what they learned into Kubernetes Engine. Kubernetes Engine combines automatic scaling, updates, and reliable self-healing infrastructure with open source flexibility to cut down your development cycles and move from idea to production quickly and reliably. Kubernetes Engine handles scheduling deployment for your workloads to maximize resource optimization so you can focus on your apps. Auto scaling allows you to handle increased demand of your services and will scale back down in the quiet periods And that is going to save you some money. Google is the only hyperscale cloud provider to offer an SLA for clusters running on Kubernetes. It's also backed by experts on Google's security and reliability engineering team, and it's both HIPAA and PCI compliant. If you're worried about getting locked in, you shouldn't be. With Kubernetes Engine, you're free to take your workloads out and run them anywhere Kubernetes is supported. It's very flexible. Learn more about Kubernetes Engine at g.co/getgke today. I'm going to say it again. I'm going to actually say it two more times. So get out your pencil or get your fingers on your keyboard. g.co/getgke. One last time. g.co/getgke.
All right. Thank you for your support. Google took its time, but it finally brought its AI-fueled portable camera, also known as Clips, to market, to release anyways. Its promise is that you can set it up and then capture your life in a raw sense that being positioned behind a smartphone like we're all used to can't achieve. Let's put that promise to the test. Joining us to give us his take on the Clips camera is Jeffrey Fowler from The Washington Post. Welcome back, Jeffrey.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. So you've had around 2 weeks now with the device. Tell us a little bit about some of the scenarios that you've pointed the Clips camera at during your time with it.
Sure. Well, when Google handed these out, and here it is, when Google handed these out to tech journalists, they went out of their ways to emphasize what this would work with and what it would not. So they said, don't clip this to your clothes to wear it around town. It's not going to – the AI won't really recognize what's going on and the camera's a little too shaky. They said they really did train it, however, for children and for pets. So I focused on those two particular areas. So I took it to kitty playtime with a bunch of 1- and 2-year-olds to see how it responded. And then I took it to a cat cafe because if the whole premise here is that this thing is supposed to be so good that it can replace that need in your life to get your smartphone out to capture it, what is the cutest possible place on earth I could go to see if I could resist getting my phone out? And that was a Kitty Cafe in San Francisco, America's first cat cafe, I learned.
That's awesome.
I have so many questions about the San Francisco cat cafe, but that's not really our topic, so I'll have to ask you that some other time. But what was really interesting was that you took it to – when you took it to the preschool and you made a good point. I think a lot of people have been talking about racist algorithms, like, you know, that there's a lot, there's like an algorithmic justice league fighting to the fact that, like, if you're a black woman, you're not going to be recognized in a lot of these, you know, these algorithms, these facial recognition algorithms, because they've just been tested on white men. So what did you find with the how's the Google Clips camera doing on that end?
Yeah. Is Google Clips racist? It's like one of the first questions that came to mind. This product raises a ton of questions. And this is just one of them, but one we should definitely talk about. So yeah, I tried it around Asian kids. I tried it around white kids. I tried it around black kids. I couldn't discern a difference in terms of how it responded to them. Obviously, you'd need a lot more testing over time, lots of different kids, but it seemed just as interested in the African-American kid as it did in the little white girl he was playing with. So there you go. Google did say that they learned their lesson from that episode of a couple of years ago, and they now put inclusion and diversity. They have whole teams at Google that try to bring that into their AI development. So in this case, it seems like they did a good job.
Now, at the heart of this camera is obviously it's the AI, and what is the AI doing? It's determining the important things to shoot. It's deciding that, oh, you know, this particular moment in time is more interesting than the others, so I'm going to go ahead and record 7 seconds of video around that. When you looked at the footage afterwards, did it do a good job? Did you look at these things and be like, wow, I'm really happy the clips captured that moment?
Yes and no. I would give it about a 50%. You know, look, when you're at a cat cafe, there are a lot of cute moments, right? And there were plenty in there that I was hoping it caught that it did not, but then also some that it did. I mean, the way AI works now, and this is sort of, you can really see it in this product, is it's less about finding that needle in the haystack, because it's just not good enough to do that yet. But what it is good at is sort of like taking some of the hay out of the stack so that you can at least then maybe kind of go through some of the things you might be interested in. I mean, I'm also someone who's tested lots of GoPros before, and I've taken GoPros, you know, and shot, you know, hours and hours and hours worth of footage. And, you know, then who's going to look at all of that? Who's going to go through all of it? And so that was really kind of the core problem that Google was trying to address. And I think they've got some interesting answers to it. Whether you want to buy this thing right now, though, that's another question.
Yeah, I definitely have so much GoPro footage that I will never do anything with it. And yeah, and I love that you called this like a GoPro with a mind of its own. And it made me think that, you know, we give up a lot. I put all my photos on Google Photos and they do amazing things with it. And whatever else they might be doing with it, it seems worth it for the trade-off. And so that's the idea here, right? Like, they're not necessarily doing anything with all this video they're constantly capturing of your children and your cats. But do you think it's worth the trade-off right now?
So what's super interesting about this product is it's the least Googly product in certain ways that I've ever seen. So this device does not connect to the internet. The artificial intelligence and the machine learning that it's using don't happen in the cloud. They're all on the device. In many ways, it's kind of like an Apple product, right? Because, you know, Apple has that kind of that sort of philosophy on privacy that they want to do as much as possible on the device itself. Well, Google did that here. And they said, because listen, they're aware that people are kind of freaked out by the idea of a Google camera that's always watching and deciding and judging. So if you want, you can use this product and benefit from its AI, but have your data, your video of your life never touch Google's servers, never touch Google's cloud. The only way it actually gets off the device and into your phone or whatever service you want to use is if you use the app and you offload it through the app and then choose to put it in Google Photos. But you could decide to not do that. You could just put it into Apple Photos if you wanted, or just save it locally on your local computer.
Can you view the camera from that app while it's live and powered, or is it all just pre-recorded stuff that you're able to offload at that point?
Sure, yeah. It does have a live preview that you can use, which is, you would think, sort of useful, but ultimately this thing is about only really useful if you're letting it decide what to take pictures of. Otherwise, you might as just use your phone, because you're probably going to get better quality, you're going to get sound, you're going to get more control anyway. So if you're going to use this kind of product, you really have to just kind of let it go. That's why I came away from this really thinking Google Clips isn't something that I feel like many people are going to go out and buy right now. However, in the next 3, 4, 5 years, I think we're going to see a lot more cameras out there that have, let's call an AI mode on it, that just like, you know, it's a setting. It's a feature that you can use to let it make some choices. So in case you are in a situation where, you know, you just want to play with the kids, you don't want to like shoot the kids. Mm-hmm. So just put it on the ground and let's see what it can do.
Yeah, it really does feel like a lot of money for a very specific use case. Sorry,
yeah.
What were you gonna say?
I know. I mean, I do think that you're right about the AI, though, because, I mean, we're already seeing that in Google Photos, and we're seeing it, I mean, in, you know, so many. I have like a, you know, Hipstamatic, which is not a new app, but it's an old app, and it just knows which filter to put on my pictures, and I don't have to think about it. And I like the idea that it would just know what to see and what not to see. Do you think that Google is also going to be using this do they use the same AI for like a security camera type device?
That's definitely where I think this is all heading. So already we have, so Google owns Nest, and Nest is kind of being brought back into the Google hardware fold. We see their Nest Cam has the ability to identify people. There are already startups out there. There's one I've been running in our San Francisco Bureau for the Post called Lighthouse, which uses some slightly more sophisticated sensors and cameras and also AI to not just sort of see, let you, you know, peek in on what's going on at home, but actually identify faces and let you know, for example, if your kids don't come home by a certain time. It uses artificial intelligence to reach out to you proactively and say, hey, this didn't happen today. You might want to know about that. And that's definitely where this is all headed. And I think this is an exciting and interesting moment to be at in consumer tech as we see all these ways for AI to get sort of brought into the products that we use to actually make them smarter, as opposed to for the last couple of years, we called a lot of things smart that weren't actually that smart.
Yeah, yeah. I should mention real quick, Lighthouse as well as Ring, actually, both sponsors on this network. I guess the final take on this, you spent 2 weeks with it. $250 worth it for you for what it gives you, or would you pass on a personal level?
On a personal level, I'm going to pass. Look, I love, you know, playing with new gadgets, but actually what this made me want is actually just to go out and buy a GoPro Hero 6, because it reminded me of the great fun that you can have by putting cameras in unexpected angles, putting them in kids' hands. I would love if the GoPro Hero 7 had some of these capabilities built into it, and I'm excited to see that. I think that's the direction that we're headed with cameras.
It really seems so. Jeffrey Fowler, it's great to talk with you again. Thank you so much for joining us today to talk about the Clips camera. We appreciate it. All right. We'll talk to you soon.
Big news this week in the world of things Amazon just bought. The retail giant has purchased one of our sponsors, Ring, the maker of smart home products. Here to discuss what this means for the future of the video doorbell many of us have watching over our homes right now is Nick Wingfield, Seattle-based tech correspondent for the New York Times. Welcome back to the show, Nick.
Thank you for having me.
So according to one of your sources, the deal was worth $1.1 billion. Does that price surprise you?
You know, what I've heard is that it actually, they had apparently pretty substantial revenues. I can't say with certainty what they were, but in the hundreds of millions of dollars. So as a multiple of the kind of revenue that they were doing, it's not a ridiculous sum of money. You know, a lot of these startups are acquired and they're either pre-revenue or they don't have substantial revenues yet. They have lots of users, but this is a company that was actually selling a lot of products. People were paying money for it. So it's not a crazy sum of money, as crazy as that might sound.
and what do you think what are their plans for Ring? What do you think they're going to do with it?
I think in the near term, not a lot. I think it will do what it's been doing. But longer term, I think what Amazon brings to the equation is machine learning, artificial intelligence, capabilities that can really turn, you know, cameras like the Ring camera into a camera that can recognize people, you know, perhaps recognize objects, and inform homeowners, I guess, about what's going on in their homes. You know, tie into Alexa, tell you when your kid, you know, enters the house, and to tell you that it's locked the door, you know, if there's integration with a smart lock. So a lot of things like that. And then beyond that, I've heard some pretty fascinating ideas about where this might be going. None of it confirmed, but you know, years out, you could imagine that this could be a data play, really, that Amazon could, for example, you know, sell insurance at some point and use the data and the intelligence behind it about the activity in front of your house, how many people come to your door. They could really use it as a kind of risk assessment for offering something like home insurance, perhaps car insurance. It's kind of interesting where this could all go.
Insurance, pharmacy, Amazon's apparently going everywhere. So Amazon has its own smart camera technology. That's the Amazon Key, I believe is what it was called. Do you think this in any way is a reflection of the performance, how Key has been working for Amazon behind the scenes, or just kind of very coincidental timing that they're picking up a Ring at about the same time?
You know, I think it's not, I mean, Key is about unattended home delivery. It's about commerce. And, you know, there's a portion of the market that will appeal to, for sure. That could be a real business one day, but I don't know. It really doesn't seem like it's about that. Ring really had a brand and distribution, and I think it's about the brand. Amazon could have taken the Cloud Cam, which is the, you know, the camera that they use for Amazon Key, and added these types of advanced capabilities that I was talking about. But Ring really has like a pretty loyal audience from what I've been able to tell. And if they've, you know, got sort of that, you know, built in audience that's willing to kind of you know, that's put these devices on their front doors, then I think it's really more about these other applications down the line, and integration with Alexa. I don't think it's so much about commerce and delivery.
Yeah, I mean, it was one of those just great ideas. I mean, we got one really early just because they were a sponsor of our network, and my parents and friends that would see it. I mean, it's also one, it has like its built in way of, you know, spreading the news because
everybody that
like,
comes to your door sees it and goes, what is that? Yeah,
but so then, you know, there's a lot of people who refuse to get Amazon Echoes. They don't, they don't want that in their house. They don't want Amazon in their house. But then, you know, here was Ring, this independent startup that they were more comfortable with. What happens now to those people who have spent the money on the Ring? Maybe they are already subscribers to the Ring service. What happens to them that now Amazon is involved where they didn't want it to be?
You know, it's a good question. I've talked to a lot of people who would never put an Echo in their house, and I presume that you know, if Ring would even heighten those concerns for established Ring users. I got to believe if you're willing to put a cloud-based camera on your front doorstep, that it's not going to. You're really not going to be bothered too much by Amazon owning it. Amazon has shown, you know, that it's pretty diligent about its privacy practices. That could always change. But if you are comfortable, you know, with this new world of connected, you know, home devices, I don't know. I don't think it's going to put them off. But I think if you aren't comfortable with those types of devices, you know, this is not going to change that.
And what about kind of broad support? I mean, obviously, prior to Amazon, Ring, you know, is not tied to a specific, let's say, a specific server of, you know, in-home IoT control, be it the Echo or be it Google Home or whatever you happen to have. Is there any indication that Amazon owning Ring might lock it down more into the Echo ecosystem as opposed to being a more open-ended kind of anybody can get it and use it sort of thing?
You know, I haven't heard one way or another. I mean, I guess the only thing I'd point out is that Amazon's actually been pretty good, better than Apple in terms of making its services available on any platform, the Kindle, you know, reader, the Kindle app is on Android, it's on iOS, it's on, you know, virtually every platform out there. So I would think if only for PR, they would want to make Ring, you know, work with some of these other intelligent assistants out there. But, you know, you got to believe there's going to be some deeper level of integration that they will provide. I don't know if they'll prevent, you know, other companies from getting access to, you know, will they delay access to certain APIs, you know, I don't know, but their track record has actually been reasonably good at making their devices work with and software work with other platforms.
You mentioned before the idea that insurance might be involved, which you didn't seem scared by that, but that, and maybe this is just I have a you know, tinfoil hat, but when I think of like, oh, I don't know that I would want my Ring to be connected to my insurance, like I don't know what's actually what would be, you know, I live in a pretty safe neighborhood, but it's like whenever you connect insurance to any kind of, you know, technology like that that's automated, it's a little scary and Big Brother-ish.
Yeah, to be clear, I'm not saying you shouldn't be scared.
Okay.
I'm saying that it might be something that they do. You know, I've written before about these car insurance companies that in exchange for putting a little, you know, device inside under your steering wheel, it'll monitor your speed, your hard braking, and it'll actually give you something in exchange. It'll give you better rates if you're a safe driver, if you drive within certain parameters. So, you know, really, Ring could be that for your home if you have, you know, the kinds of things that deter people from coming to your house, a dog that barks, lights that are on, you know, a fence or whatever it might be. Then maybe they cut you a deal on insurance rates. Maybe they bundle it in with Prime in some way. Prime insurance. I mean, who knows? But it you know, for sure, this will not deter the, you know, the people from who have the Amazon tinfoil hats from being concerned about this company's, you know, all-encompassing, you know, movement into our lives, into groceries, into everything else.
Yeah, very similar to what happened when Amazon, you know, announced that it was buying Whole Foods and a lot of the other grocery chains, you know, their stock kind of plummeted. We saw a little bit of that this time around too. Longstanding security companies like ADT, for example, their stock dropped almost immediately on this news. Should they be worried about Amazon coming into this? I guess anybody should be worried when Amazon decides, hey, you know, we're going to make a move that, you know, that challenges you. But I suppose that's why we're seeing the reaction.
You know, it's not a market I won't claim to be super familiar with, the home security market. I think that there have been efforts by, you know, the ADTs, Alarm.coms and Comcast to embrace some of these smart home devices. But there's a long way to go before Amazon has kind of the full suite of, products that these companies offer, motion sensors in the home for, you know, detecting intruders or, you know, whatever else it is that that these companies offer. But they do have way better software expertise. And I think a lot of this, that's my understanding of where a lot of these home security devices is trending, is in the direction of software, being more intelligent, being able to distinguish between people who, you know, are animals that, you know, should be somewhere or not. And, if they can come out with a suite of products, then I think you could be talking about a much serious competitor. And also don't underestimate the ability of Amazon to bundle this. I mean, that's what Prime has become, is this massive, you know, bundle that has your free shipping and it has your streaming and your music. And maybe it'll eventually have home security at a much, much lower price than what these other companies are charging you for.
Mm. Well, you know, of course, Amazon has bought a lot of different companies, and they treat them in different ways. Audible is kept pretty separate, Zappos separate. But Whole Foods, you have a piece today about Whole Foods and the changes that have come. It seems to be a little bit different. What are some of the big changes people are already seeing in the Whole Foods now that Amazon, the purchase is all the way complete?
Yeah, I would describe it as more cosmetic might not be the right word exactly, but there are much bigger plans, some of which they've talked about. You know, it's the obvious stuff like Prime Now delivery, 2-hour delivery. So they're piggybacking on top of this, you know, existing Amazon delivery service for getting goods to you quickly. They're piloting it in 4 different cities, eventually going to expand it to the rest of the country. That could be, I think, a pretty significant deal down the line once they expand it everywhere. Then you have other stuff like prices. And I think Amazon's gotten a lot of PR value out of cutting the prices of avocados and bananas and hamburger, but it really has not been a super substantial reduction in prices across the board. It's still kind of whole paycheck. And it's going to take time for them to change that. We'll see if they do. They say that prices is a big focus, making things cheaper. And as we've seen in other markets, books and so on, electronics, they really have brought prices down. But that's still, you know, to be seen. The Prime integration is just getting started. There's a lot more that they'll do there. They've already talked about making Prime the rewards program for Whole Foods stores. They haven't kind of completed that technical work yet, but eventually there's going to be some way to, you know, tie in your Prime account to Whole Foods. Maybe that's the way you'll get cheaper prices. They'll give, you know, people another reason to get a Prime subscription. Maybe it becomes a little more like Costco. I don't know.
I just want the store like the Amazon Go. I want to walk out with my groceries and feel like I just stole them.
they say that they're not going to use that automated technology in their stores, but I find that very difficult to believe that they won't use that or some similar kind of technology over the long term. But it's probably not going to happen for a while.
Well, Nick, thank you so much for joining us. Nick Winfield covers tech in the Northwest, including Amazon, Microsoft, and others. And he is at the New York Times, and he's Nick Winfield on Twitter. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Nick.
You bet.
Appreciate it.
All right. Are you looking for a way to cut your tech addiction, your iPhone or your Android addiction?
Sure. I'm always looking. Yeah.
I know. It's a complicated topic, but you.
Me.
If you're feeling addicted to your phone, you might want to try the Lite Phone 2. It's a new Indiegogo project for a device that only lets you call, text, and get directions. The first version, the Lite Phone 1, you couldn't even text. So this is a great upgrade for you Lite Phone 1 users. According to the creators, this credit card size device is, quote, a phone that actually respects you. I didn't really know that was something I was looking for in a smartphone, but okay. The phone is from a Brooklyn-based startup, obviously, and it has an e-ink touchscreen. It's designed to be used as little as possible. I personally would not like to use one at all. What do you think?
You probably would use it less because it's capable of less. It's also e-ink, so I'm wondering what the refresh rate on that is, because if it's really slow,
that would make
you want to use it less.
Calling and texting and getting directions?
Yeah, it's that. I guess for its purpose, you know, for why it exists, to get you to use your phone less, I guess that's the right way to do it, right? Trim it down. I just find it interesting that we've totally come full circle at this point. Years ago, we had phones that didn't do very much because that's just the way it was and that's the technology we had. Now we're at a point where our phones can do everything, and you know, we're moving back in the direction to where a phone that doesn't do too much is a feature and not a failing.
Right. I mean, if someone said you have to switch to like a Nokia flip phone or this, I would choose this.
Yeah.
Because I do think it's well designed for not, you know, whereas Nokia just reminds me of, you know, just a really, like, if every time I look at that phone, I think of like waiting for, you know, a web page to come up or something, just how slow the cell networks used to. So this just seems like a sort of futuristic communication device.
Sure.
And I'm not going to get one.
If it's e-ink, I wonder what the battery life on something like this would be too. Because, I mean, e-ink, you refresh it and then you're done. It's not actively, you know, powering a display the way modern phones do. So you probably get really great battery life out of it. So if you need a phone, I'm guessing if you need a phone that, you know, can last you a really long time, maybe you're going on a trip, you want a low profile in your bags or whatever, and you want it to last the whole time, this might be a good pick. This isn't the only phone that's done the e-ink display either. I don't know if you ever heard of the Yoda phone. Mm. Also looks like Yoda phone, but they had a few of those, and that was basically an Android, traditional Android display on the front, and then on the back, when you turned it over, the back was an e-ink display that you could actually also interact with on an Android UI basis. It was a touchscreen e-ink display, but again, on e-ink, the refresh rate was slow enough that a lot of those animations and what we're used to being able to control it is just a lot slower.
So it has a headphone jack.
Oh, it has a Courage port.
It has a Courage port.
That's not mine, by the way. Matteo Doni, who's a freaking guest.
And let's see. The battery is 5 days on standby, a few hours talk time, USB-C.
Okay.
Nano SIM.
Gosh, how big is the battery? Then?
Loudspeaker.
I would expect more. But I guess, yeah.
Well, no cost?
Is there a cost on here?
Yeah, it's an Indiegogo project, so it's $250 for if you back it now.
Oh, okay.
And you get $450 for two for couples Lite phone.
Well, so $250 if you back it now with $400 crossed off, 37% discount. So a $400 very minimal phone, that feels a little pricey.
That's expensive for not having any self-control.
Although maybe that's what you're buying. You're paying for a device that will give you self-control because it forces it down your throat, basically.
Yeah, I mean, Scott Hanselman from Microsoft, who we've had on the show before, he tweeted, this is where I saw it on his Twitter feed, and he said he was thinking about getting it for his kids who don't have phones yet. And
they're going to hate you.
Yeah, That's what I said.
I mean, you could do that.
Totally buy that for your kids if you don't. But you know, it's not. Yeah, it's not your job as a parent to be their best friend. But I tried to give my daughter my old Android phone, and that didn't even work. So
you don't do that. And I host a show on Android. You don't do that. I don't know. I don't know what I'm going to do when my kids are old enough. Like, to be honest, they're so used to Android because that's what we have in mm-hmm. our home that I don't even think they'd think twice. Although they are very iPhone aware, mm-hmm. and I blame YouTube for that. And maybe they're friends at school. Who knows? But I'm pretty sure they wouldn't. You know. Well, actually, at their age right now, they'd probably be stoked to get this. They'd use it as a toy.
Yeah.
Probably not the way it's meant to be used. Mm-hmm. Tech News Weekly records live every Thursday starting at 2:30 p.m. Pacific, 5:30 p.m. Eastern. You can be part of the show by emailing us at tnw@twit.tv. You can also let us know how you feel about everything that we're doing here at Twit, twit.tv/survey. If you want to fill that out, you can let us know what content you're liking, maybe what you're not liking, ideas, all that kind of stuff, as much or as little as you want to fill out there. We appreciate it.
And you can subscribe to our show at twit.tv/TNW. We really appreciate that. If you have an Amazon Echo, you can listen to our flash briefing. And it's not just in the United States anymore. It's now available in Canada, Australia, the United Kingdom, and India. So go to your Amazon app on your phone and put us first. You can move us all the way to the top because we have fresh content every day. And if you want to tweet at me about whatever you want to tweet at me about, I'm at Megan Maroney.
And I'm at Jason Howell on Twitter. Thanks to everyone who helps out. Josh, Jammer B, Burke, of course. Colleen, I think she was in here. Padre was not in here, but thanks anyways for being Padre. And thanks to you for watching Tech News Weekly. And we'll see all that. Oh, there he is. There's Padre. He just ran in. I'm serious. We'll see y'all next week on Tech News Weekly. Bye, everybody.